James Heim II.
And I'm Mark LaCour.
And you're listening to This Week in Oil and Gas. This is the podcast for oil pros who quickly want to keep their finger on the pulse of the industry. We do this every Friday, roughly 20 minutes, as fast as we can, through all of the most important things. If you've never heard of me before, I am James Heim II, the founder and the CEO of a company called Tribe Rocket. We are basically brand architects. We do a lot of work in digital as well. What's up with you, Mark?
And I'm Mark LaCour. When I'm not out help teaching STEMs in my local high school, I run a little company called Modal Point, where we do real market research in the oil and gas industry.
All right, we got a lot of markets to talk about today. Kicking off with a big dollar amount, Petronas in a $5 billion blockbuster bond issue. I was looking through this story and a lot of very interesting details that maybe I am wading a little bit in over my head because I haven't dealt too much in international finance yet. So can you give us a rundown on what's happening here?
Yeah, so basically Petronas is raising cash by issuing bonds. What's different, Petronas is a national oil company in Malaysia. And because they're in Malaysia, they have to meet Islamic trade rules. And not to get too deep into the Quran, but basically the rules in Islam are a little bit different about the profitability that investors can make to try to make sure everything is always fair. So they raise a little bit less cash than anticipated, but they're doing pretty well. And of course, you know, the question is, what are they going to do with this cash? And there's several choices. They can either buy back stock, or they can pay off debt, or they're going to do what I think they're going to do, which is basically they're going to try to acquire assets.
Probably more Chinese assets?
You know, that's a hard one to figure out. You know, Malaysia is in Asia Pacific, is one of the key oil producers in Asia Pacific. One of their biggest customers is China. But one of the places that they actually can get better lease rates are actually outside of the Chinese market. So, you know, I suspect that they'll probably buy some assets outside of China with intent of taking that crude and natural gas and selling it to China.
So the reason I bring up China is because they talk about the nearest comparable for the seven-year offering is its outstanding 7.875% bond rated for the China National Offshore Oil Corporation 3.875 bond, which expires in May 2020. And so there's some only a handful of other long-term bond offerings that investors can even look at to compare if this is a good deal. It seems
And you're talking about CNOOC offering, which is the nationalized oil company in China. You know, those NOC offerings can be very tricky, and I'm no financial expert, so please, nobody on the show, you know, purchase stock based on what we're talking about. But it seems like Petronas is doing the right thing to raise cash.
Yeah, yeah. Well, speaking of cash, this second link is something that I've followed this just from afar over the last few years, because the fracking fight continues in the UK, and they're still pushing to be able to get some momentum around an energy policy that's sustainable for what they're doing there. So. What's your take on what's going on in the UK and how long it's taken them to be able to do anything there?
Yeah, so we got to do a little bit of background here. So basically, in the US and Europe, we have started the decline of air pollution, right? In the US, our air pollution peaked in the 1980s and it's went downhill since there. Same way in Europe. And what's happened is the European government, the smart people, understand what's going on, realize that fracked natural gas is a fuel of the future. Compared to burning coal, it's 100% cleaner. And so it just makes common sense to move their energy needs over to natural gas, which they have abundant supply of. The issue is that the public in the Europe, and then here in the US, a lot of the general public think that fracking is dangerous and it causes earthquakes and water contamination, and it's just not true. So now the European governments need to help start educating their people so they can enter this thing intellectually sound and where everybody understands the benefits of frack gas.
Yeah, and it's been going on for quite a while, and I'm just gonna root for that to happen because it's really silly. I'm just gonna say that. It's silly.
Yeah, and you know, luckily for the UK at least, their current parliament, most of their members understand that it's silly. right? Now it's a matter of making sure that the population gets well educated. I actually think, even though Europe's behind us, I think they'll actually probably pull ahead of us as far as regulation in the next 10 years.
Well, sticking with the British, but the exiled misfit British down in Australia, we have a headline here: Australia achieves record gas production. And it was a very interesting article to me because this sounds like a good news article. I'm like, yes, I know, the only reason I do know anything about Australian oil and gas is from my time at Drilling Info, where I dropped those links on you. You said, why the heck are you sending me these? I think that Americans don't really understand how large the continent of Australia is, and so I have this map fight: Texas versus I have a Texas versus Australia one. Australia is actually 11 times the size of Texas, and to put that in perspective, Texas is 25 times the size of Australia, or I'm sorry, of Massachusetts. Goodness. And so my point is that if, you know, we're going to drop this link in the show notes. And there's good stuff in here about the record production, but you have to really look for it because it's surrounded by all this negativity about, you know, decreases in this, all of these different things. And I guess the point that I'm looking at in this story here, Mark, that I'd like to just underscore is the fact that they have unbelievably huge deposits of natural gas in Australia, and, you know, if you get lured in by the good headline, don't let the bad news draw you down, because there's so much natural gas there that the world is not going to collapse.
Yeah, and so Chevron, and I sometimes think that Chevron has a crystal ball. Chevron figured this out over 10 years ago, before fracking was even around, and did some joint ventures in Australia and got one of the first LNG plants online in the world, knowing they could take this cheap gas that would eventually come from frack in Australia, compress it down to liquid, and ship it to the rest of Asia Pacific at a very good profit. So it's good for the Australian economy. The funny thing about Australia for me is politically they tend to be more liberal. But once they saw the benefits of the frack gas and the money that could be made in the stimulation economy, they were all over it. So Australia is ahead of both Europe and the U.S. from a regulation point of view, which, you know, 10 years ago, you would have never said that happened. But they quickly saw, you know, the green light and how this was good for them and good for the environment.
What's amazing, though, as well, and I don't know the current state of equipment down there and so forth, but I know that, I want to say 2 years ago, yeah, probably was 2013. I want to say 2013 or 2012. They only had two fracking crews on the entire continent.
Yep. They ramped up extremely quickly.
So I don't know. I have a thing for Australia just because it's because I know how much production is there, and I was excited to see that, and then let down by the reporter. But what's new?
Yeah, but that was the way the reporter wrote the article. The truth is, in Australia, their electricity prices have plummeted. Their air emissions have went down because of all this cheap gas. So it's just good. It's good for everybody.
Absolutely. All right. And now we're going back down with Mid-East oil and gas transactions dip in 2014. Now, this is the confusing thing to me, is because we start off with, so they decreased from 2013 to 2014. But then they start analyzing that based off of what's happening in 2015. And of course, they talk about how there's no midstream happening, there's no downstream happening, because it's, you know, these national companies are owning own all the assets there. But is there really anything to say about, you know, declining deals in the Middle East?
No, I mean, not at all. So basically, this article is talking about there's less mergers and acquisitions, less transactions actually happen in the Middle East. Well, of course, all of the Middle East oil companies are state owned. You know, and you think about our government, how many times does, you know, the FBI sell something to Department of Defense? It just doesn't happen. So
right.
This article is once again showing a little bit how the news likes to cast a negative light on stuff. The Middle East, because they're all state owned, are just not going to have this series of mergers and acquisitions that you have in the free market like the U.S.
Thank you. Thank you. More depths for the free market here. All right, so let's move on. We've got So this headline was a little confusing to me because it says once in a very long time opportunity for majors to get into Canadian oil and gas. From my perspective, we just saw a bunch of majors get out of the shale plays in America because they didn't know how to do it. You know, it is really the mid majors and the smaller guys that are that really know how to efficiently operate in these shale plays. And so, you know, I guess when I read it, it sort of started to feel more like a sales pitch than anything. But is it true? I mean, will majors who just exited, plays in the States because they couldn't figure out how to make them economical, are they going to turn around and say, oh, yeah, well, let's make it work in Canada now?
Yeah, no. So this article is misleading. The title is misleading. So when the title talks about the majors, they're really not talking about the majors. So, you know, everybody on this podcast probably knows the majors are, you know, Exxon, BP, Chevron, Shell, Total, whatever. This guy's actually talking about smaller companies like Talisman Energy,
yep.
Repsol. And yes, when these assets are devalued, these companies that missed out on this first shell rush. Well, of course, look at these assets again while they're devalued and see if it makes sense for their portfolio. You know, we predicted the end of last year that this year, 2015, would be one of the largest mergers and acquisitions in the history of oil and gas, and that's what's happening here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a good look. I didn't even notice that, but that is a great point. Yeah, they mentioned Talisman, being picked up by Reps. Yeah, okay. Come on, guys. Let's get our act together out there. All right, Mark West and Targa Resources. Now we're moving to midstream. We got some midstream M&A, and we there's no way we could slice and dice this entire article because there's a heck of a lot of numbers in here, and I thought it was pretty well written. Interesting, I have to mention it here. Even T. Boone Pickens is jumping in with his BP Natural Gas Opportunity Partners LP in January, committing $20 million to Pinnacle Midstream LLC. So continuing the midstream march that we've been talking about for a couple weeks.
Yeah, and yeah, we've been talking about this. So basically what's happening is the really good midstream guys are looking at the midstream guys that aren't so good and looking to see if it's worth picking them up for their portfolio. You know, the thing about a pipeline systems in the U.S., the more reach you have, especially to markets, the more profitable you'll be for your investors and your shareholder value goes up. So this is, once again, tying back into the M&A activity that we would predict for this part of the 2015.
Yeah, and that seemed to be one point in the article as well, that things are just getting started. It seems like maybe off to a slow start, but that's just because there's so many deals to evaluate, and that eventually there's going to be several billions billion closed by the end of the year.
Yeah, and you and I both know that nobody in the oil and gas industry moves fast.
So. yes, I do, unfortunately. But that's why you're here, to help me cut my sales cycles. So, get ready. So we moved to midstream away from the international, and now, we're into, more kind of M&A talk, I suppose, which is that shale is going on sale. So kind of continuing this, to this discussion about assets that you're going to be able to pick up on the cheap.
Yeah, and so this article is a good article. It's a good showcase. They're talking about Whitney Petroleum, which was not one of the better shale players. They had a choice between filing bankruptcy or selling themselves. So they're selling themselves, which is a smart business move. And you're going to see a lot of that this year. The good shale players are in great position to snap up the shale players that were not so good, that didn't have good, strong financial models. It's just, once again, merger and acquisition activity based upon the market.
I just realized that I knew about this deal before anybody else did, but I won't say how. Haynesville shale gas cuts lures drillers from Marcellus. I love this headline and I love this article, and I'll tell you why. Well, first of all, I have a vested interest in Louisiana now because my clients Ilios Resources over there, who buy and sell minerals and so forth. I don't know. I just love Louisiana. I also spent one semester at XU, Xavier University. But also, it sometimes it feels like the Haynesville is like, oh, I don't know, the hair band from the 80s or something that nobody really talks about anymore. And so I'm loving seeing this, people are actually going down. And the one point that sort of stood out to me was about the break-even cost for a Haynesville well falling from, whatever to, 230 to 240 versus $4 2 years ago. So it just speaks to the operational efficiencies that have taken place in really what people have learned over time. And so I love to hear about people heading back to the Haynesville.
Yeah, you hit it spot on. So what happens is Haynesville is a much older formation, has been drilled for much longer. And so the operators up there have learned, they spent more time. They know exactly how to frack. They know exactly, how to maneuver horizontally through what shelves. They know exactly what chemicals to use because they've been doing it longer. So that increases operational efficiency, which then lowers their cost. And it's interesting to see that a lot of operators exited Haynesville, and now because of what's going on in the shale economy, they're actually going back. So it's, once again, it's supply and demand in the oil field.
Absolutely. And so this next one, I actually, it didn't deliver on what I was, and actually, now that I realize it, this is the one that felt like a sales pitch, because it was literally, there's a quote in here that's like, here it is, our assets are some of the best, most economic, I'm like, come on, guys, is this a press release and a news story? The point that I wanted to bring up here, so the headline here, getting paid to wait for an oil recovery, hedging program, shields Crescent Point Energy Corp from downturn. But they don't really get into really what hedging programs are and what they can do. I gotta admit my somewhat ignorance on this, because I actually just started learning about hedging while I was charging my cell phone at NAEP. Actually, there was a couple guys there, and we struck up a conversation, and I was able to. Oh, okay, so it's kind of like a 3-year mortgage, whatever, like an ARM, like an adjustable rate mortgage. So you can lock in today and get paid for the price today, no matter what it is in the future. And so can you maybe just unpack that a little bit about?
Yeah, so you're spot on. Hedging is basically a way that if you do your math right and you have a little bit of luck, you're protected from the lows of the commodity price, right? So you basically agree to sell X amount of whatever the commodity is for X amount of price, and you're locked in for a term, for a length of time. And everybody hedges. I mean, everybody hedges. And there's layers and layers of hedging, literally from before the well is even considered to be drilled to the point of production. There's a lot of layers of profitability that's built into that. And like everything else, there's some people that are really, really good at hedging, and there's some people that are not so good. And the people that are really good are actually very protected right now. They're very safe. They're sitting on a lot of cash, and they're able to make strategic decisions about acquiring new assets. The guys that were not so good at hedging, they're upside down, and unfortunately, they're going to suffer because of that.
Yeah, cash strapped and so forth. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this next one. Obama's remarks about Keystone XL need some corrections. Not a surprise. Although I being an avid hockey fan and a listener to a lot of Canadian sports talk radio, I do have to give a plug to our fellow Canadian here, Cody Bedershill. Yeah. because I really like some of the points that he made here, and the number one point being that Obama basically said, "Hey, this is just for Canadian oil to get down to refineries, and we don't need the Canadians." And the point being, well, no, there's actually millions and millions of oil barrels of oil coming out of the Bakken that need to get to refineries as well.
Yeah, and there's a couple things. I mean, the president is not an oil and gas guy, and most of Congress isn't. They don't literally understand what's going on. Our refineries cannot refine sweet crude, right? That's what we're producing in the frack fields. Our refineries are set up to refine sour crude from the Middle East. So we need the sour or heavy crude from Canada to mix or blend with our sweet crude so the refineries can actually refine it. So there's a need for it. And quite honestly, if you're worried about the environment, the U.S. is the best place to ship Canadian crude, because I promise you, if we don't buy it, China will buy it. And China is nowhere near as clean as the U.S. is when they're using hydrocarbons. So, this is just and I do like the fact this is a Canadian writing this article, and he's very factual about it. So it was a well-written article.
Absolutely. And so now we're moving over to Seeking Alpha. By the way, just to throw this in, Seeking Alpha, if you're not subscribed, it is a free login. And so you just, you know, put in your name and you have to, I think you, yeah, part of the login part is that you list a couple companies that you want to follow or something. So we're going to link this in the show notes. And if you open it and you're not able to see the whole story, go ahead and sign up. It's a really, it's worth it. Because they do a lot of great analysis. And I liked one line from the conclusion, because there's a lot of stuff that we could talk about here, which is rig count data is a lagging indicator at best, perhaps no indicator at all.
Yeah, and you know, that's, once again, people don't understand the industry. So at a high level, rig count does not equal production. While you're drilling, you're not producing. You're spending money, right? Once that rig is gone, then you actually go into production. You start producing hydrocarbons. That's one thing. And then the other thing is a newer, higher horsepower rig can out-drill these older rigs by a 10-to-1 ratio. So a lot of these older rigs are getting retired first, but the high-performance rigs are staying on site. So, you know, once again, this is some really good data. I'm a big fan of Seeking Alpha as well. But the correlation between production and rig count is not necessarily linear.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we're going to throw this in the show notes because Alan Gilmer from Drilling Info was quoted in the Houston Business Journal with a pretty much the exact same headline, but that was from last month. New U.S. drilling index rig counts are misleading. And on that drilling index, did you have a chance to look at this link real quick, this new index they put up?
Yep, I think it's really cool. So at a glance, you can see everything, not everything, but most of the important metrics, what's going on upstream.
Yeah, and it's kind of meant to be a little bit of a like a NYMEX for oil and gas. And one of the things, because I helped it, obviously back when I was working there, in his Twitter profile, he put radical transparency, and that's really what's going on here, because we can see the rig counts, the U.S. permits from a high. It's just really cool the way that the data is displayed, and then you can they've got some kind of heat maps on new wells and rig movements and everything. So we're gonna link all that stuff up in the show notes so that that you can have a look there. I do wonder, Mark. You can let me know, because you've been in this industry longer. When this came out, or you know, even if someone's just finding out, if you're an executive VP at Southwestern Energy and you come up here and it says operator down two, are you mad? Like what? Like how do they feel when they see something like this?
You know, that's a good question. It's unfortunately, this is one of my pet peeves, and I have a passion for oil and gas industry, so I'm not banging on the oil and gas industry. It's one of my pet peeves of the industry is a lot of people in the industry won't take the time to correct the misinformation that's out there, right? So then the general public only gets fed misinformation, and then they start believing it. So, you know, I think a lot of the people in the industry, when they read stuff like this, it upsets them. But I wish someone would maybe take that next step and maybe put a comment in and saying, hey, you're wrong about this, or this is how it really should be. I think we need more of that from our industry.
Yeah, and I think that goes along with this whole, even just that notion that I mentioned before about radical transparency. But this is now becoming the oil and the digital marketing podcast. So let's keep it with this week. Those are all of our stories from this week. Obviously, we're going to link everything up in the show notes. We haven't had any comments yet, but we haven't done a call to action for comments. We'd be interested in to hear what y'all think was the biggest story of this week. On the blog post, that, you know, there's just a little place there. We'd love to hear your perspective on some of these things. So feel free to drop us a note in there. You can always reach me at james@triberocket.com. Mark McCour, how do we get a hold of you?
Yeah, it's best bet is hit me up on Twitter. It's Mark_LaCour. It's MARK_LACOUR. And I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
All right, cool. Yeah, we'll put all these links in the show notes. And we appreciate you checking us out, guys. In the meantime, Mr. Mark LaCour, what do you wish them to do?
Do great work, pay it forward, and just enjoy life.
Let's go find some grease, guys. We'll talk to you next week.